Welcome to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. I'm your aptly named host and the podfather of your favorite hebdomadal podcast. Oh, I'm glad you're with us. I'd suffer with thermohyphesthesia if you made me hot with the idea that you missed this week's show. Here's our associate producer, Kate, to introduce it.
Hey, Tony. Here's what's going on. The new tax law. What it means for your fundraising right now and in 2026. In January, there are substantial changes coming to tax and donation laws that impact your fundraising messages for end of year and in the new year. Russell James returns to explain the details of these important changes for individuals and corporations. He's a professor at Texas Tech University, where he studies charitable giving. On Tony's Take 2.
You may have a GoFundMe page you don't know about.
Here is the new tax law, what it means for your fundraising right now and in 2026.
It is a genuine pleasure to welcome back Russell James. He is a professor in the School of Financial Planning at Texas Tech University, where he directs the graduate program in charitable financial planning, which is planned giving. He has a law degree and a PhD from the University of Missouri. His doctoral dissertation was on charitable giving. Prior to his career as an academic researcher, he worked as the director of planned giving for Central Christian College in Moberly, Missouri, and for six years, and later served as president of the college. You'll find his vast body of research, all free, at encouragegenerosity.com, and you will find Russell James very active on LinkedIn. Russell, welcome back to Nonprofit Radio.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
It's a pleasure. I don't know if we've talked about you have a deep history in Missouri. Are you from Missouri originally?
Yes, actually, my wife and I and our families are from Missouri. Although I've lived in West Texas here at Texas Tech University for the last 15 years, and I was at University of Georgia for a number of years. But yes, that's the origins.
Okay. Yeah, I lived in Missouri for 5 years.
Really?
I was stationed at Whiteman Air Force Base in Warrensburg.
Of course, yes. So, Central Missouri State University when I was in high school.
Exactly, that which now has a different name. So it's Central Missouri University or something.
I think that's right, yes.
It has a different name, but it was CMSU when I was there in the early to mid, it would have been mid-80s. I got there by 85. Mid to late 80s, I was there.
Okay,
I loved Warrensburg. We used to go to Kansas City, to the Plaza a lot.
Yeah.
So I lived there 5 years. I'm not from there, but like you are, but we have that in common. I don't know if we ever talked about that.
Yeah, I have lots of friends that live there.
The great state, the show me state.
Exactly.
All right. We're here to, I wanted folks to get your advice to get smart about the implications of the huge sweeping bill, the big beautiful bill. Mm-hmm. By the end of this, we may be calling it the burdensome bill. it makes charitable giving more complicated. Mm. If you can give us an overview, and then I'd like to follow the path for non-itemizers. Mm-hmm. And then separately, the path for itemizers, and then bring it all together, what this means for fundraisers.
Right.
If you can just give us a little overview of the more complicated landscape that we're facing come 2026 for charitable giving.
Yeah, so a couple of things to keep in mind. I think the number one message, especially for fundraisers, is to understand that all of the incentives for people who are itemizers or close to itemizing is to move those charitable deductions into 2025 before their value is going to drop. So the idea is this. Itemized deductions have a certain value. That value is going to be cut next year. Now, if you take them this year, they're still just as valuable, but next year, they're cut in a couple of ways. First, you're going to lose the deductions below 0.5% of income. That's AGI. So that kind of haircut just comes right off the top next year. That doesn't happen if you pull them into the current year. The other thing that happens next year is if you're at that very top 37% tax bracket, well, that deduction doesn't get used at 37% anymore. It only gets used at 35%. Again, another haircut from the benefit of itemized deductions. So what we're encouraging people to do is to pull those deductions forward as much as possible into 2025. How do you do that?
We'll get there. But yes, that's a perfect high-level view, because there's a new floor coming for some folks and there's a ceiling for some folks. Mm-hmm. All right. So let's I'd like to track one at a time, like
yes.
Non-itemizers. So people yes. who typically don't itemize, mm-hmm. They're taking only the standard deduction. That's because that's 90 or more percent of taxpayers right now, right, are not itemizing. They're just filling out aren't we talking about the 1040 EZ? Mm-hmm. Right?
Right. So 90% of taxpayers do not itemize. So how do you get benefits from your charitable giving if you don't itemize? Three different ways. One, as I mentioned before, if you pick a target year, you pull your charitable giving into that year, so you only have 1 year when you make the big transfers into your donor advised fund or some other way, and you itemize in just that 1 year, but then you just take the standard deductions in other years. Number two, something that'll start next year, can't do it yet, but next year, is everybody can use $1,000 off the top charitable deduction. Don't have to itemize. In fact, you can't use it if you're itemizing. And so that's brand new. It's similar to what we had during the pandemic and the year after the pandemic when we got that above the line tax deduction for charitable giving. Well, that's going to come back starting next year, and it'll be $1,000 per person. The third way that you can get benefits, tax benefits, if you're not itemizing, is actually to use charitable planning to avoid recognizing income. So this is not an income deduction. This is income avoidance. Two ways we can do that. One, if you've got an asset, you sell it for more than you paid for it, you got to pay taxes on that difference. That's called a capital gain. But if you donate that asset, you get a tax deduction for the full value of the asset if you've owned it for more than a year, and you don't recognize any of that gain. The second way you can do that is if you happen to be age 70 and a half or older. Well, once you've reached that age, you can pull money out of your IRA or IRA rollover, not recognize it as income because you send it directly to the charity. It also counts against any required minimum distributions that are going to force you to pull that money out and recognize the income. So
that's
the
QCD, or the qualified
QCD.
Charitable distribution. Some folks call it the IRA charitable rollover.
Exactly.
That's what you're describing for folks 70 and a half or over. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So those are the three ways that non-itemizers can look to get tax benefits from their giving.
Now, for non-itemizers, sticking with them for the time being, what if they give in 2025, mm-hmm. they're not recognizing a charitable deduction. It's just going to be lumped in with their current standard deduction. But if they give in 2026, they have that $1,000 that you just described of
exactly.
charitable deduction available. It's not a given. You have to make the gifts mm-hmm. up mm-hmm. to $1,000. Mm-hmm. So is our advice to non-itemizers to maybe not give in this year, but maybe give in January of 2026 instead of December 2025? Or is that incorrect?
Well, so it depends on who you are. So if you're a financial advisor, the answer is that's correct. Just hold off and make your gift January. If you're a fundraiser, just don't bring up the topic, right? Because you don't want to discourage people from giving.
Well, that's why I said January. Yeah. So, when we bring this all together, it becomes a conundrum too for fundraisers, because you know, we have no idea really who's itemizing and who's not itemizing. I mean, we can make guesses, but you know, maybe based on, you know, someone who we know has high income or someone we know owns their own business, you know, those folks are more likely to itemize. But those are just, again, those are just sort of educated guesses. And those are the folks that we know best. We have close relationships with folks who are just giving on a routine basis, you know, $1,000, even $1,500 a year. You know, we can't have the, unless we're the very smallest charities, we don't have relationships with those folks to know what their individual circumstances are for us to even make an educated or semi-educated guess about whether they itemize or non-itemize. So it's a bit of a conundrum for fundraisers too.
Well, let me point this out, though, that might be helpful. It is true that 90% of taxpayers aren't itemizing, right? However, it's also true that for most nonprofits, 80 to 90% of your charitable dollars are going to come from that 10% of itemizers. So don't be sort of thrown off the trail by saying, well, most people this doesn't apply to, but it does apply to most of your charitable dollars coming in.
So more likely to have relationships with those. All right. More likely to have the relationships that I was describing, where you'd be able to make an educated or at least semi-educated guess.
Well, now, and I would say feel comfortable communicating this information broadly, because even if it only applies to the 10%, it's the 10% that's going to drive all of your bottom line results.
The majority. Right. All right. Let's track over to itemizers. Mm-hmm. So for itemizers, 2025, right? Here's where give now.
Yes.
Give now and don't be subject to any of this confusion in 2026.
Yes, absolutely. So this is, if you think of it from a policy perspective, the good and the bad of what happened in charitable planning is, number one, the big, great, good item. We got that above the line tax deduction for $1,000. How do we pay for it? We penalize the itemizer's charitable deduction. So that was actually the trade-off. So if you are itemizing, you want to take those deductions this year. And typically that's done through pushing them into your donor advised fund so that you pre-fund your giving for the next several years before the value of those deductions drops next year.
Right. So next year, the itemizers now have a new floor. They have to go ahead, acquaint us with that.
Yeah. So the new thing that starts next year is that, you know, let's say you have a set of your tax deductions and you make $100,000 a year. Well, we're just going to shave off $500 from those deductions, right? That's the 0.5% floor. And so we start with that. Then again, the charitable deduction starting next year can only count up to a maximum of 35%, even if you're at the 37% income tax bracket. So a little bit of a ceiling, a little bit of a floor. And actually, I should mention, Tony, this is going to be even more extreme for corporate donors. So for corporate donors, they can get that tax deduction only if they're above 1% of their net income and below 10% of their net income. Any giving above that or below that doesn't give them any benefit at all. And so what we're actually seeing in that space is a very strong advisor recommendation for corporations to set up donor advised funds.
Oh, corporations can set up donor advised funds.
Yes.
All right. Oh, interesting. All right. And there's also a message for your corporate donors to accelerate, give this year. Don't be subject to the 1% floor.
Exactly.
Next year. And likewise now we're still talking about itemizers on the individual side. Mm-hmm. So to itemizers, each year, let's assume there aren't any additional tax changes. The way it looks now, the way the landscape is now, each year your itemizing donors face this 0.5% of adjusted gross income floor. Mm-hmm. So that that first up to 0.5% doesn't count for them.
Exactly.
Right. So why, your point, why make them face that every single year? You've got to get over that floor before your charitable giving is deductible. Again, mm-hmm. these are itemizers, keeping this all straight for folks. This is the itemizing population that at 10%, but Russell, as you said, accounts for what, 80 to 90% of charitable revenue. So, so for that, those folks, those itemizers, why make them face that 0.5% of adjusted gross income floor year after year after year? And that's where I'm a little surprised you haven't said the word bunching yet. I'm waiting. But so for these folks, and it has implications on the other side too for non-itemizers, but let's stick with the itemizers. Mm-hmm. Bunching. Why is bunching the recommended course?
It's always been powerful, but now it becomes much more powerful. What is bunching? Well, we start with the simple idea. Suppose somebody is facing a standard deduction of, say, $15,000 a year. And so for 4 years, they give $10,000 each year. Well, if they don't have any other deductions, they're not going to itemize. They can't use those charitable deductions normally. But if they took all, say, 4 years worth of that giving, $40,000, if they stuffed it into a donor advised fund in year one and this just paid it out over the next few years, they can take that great big tax deduction in year one. That's the year that they itemize. And then in the other years, then they don't itemize. Well, that's the idea of bunching. And it's typically done with donor advised funds that allow you to do that. That bunching is going to become more powerful for a number of different reasons. Now, one of those reasons is, of course, if we could choose to itemize in 2 years or just itemize in 1 year, well, if we itemize charitable deductions in 2 years, that means we've got that floor penalty that we've got to pay twice in year one and year two. But if we stuff it all into year one, then we've only got to pay that floor penalty once, right? So another reason to stuff that in. The other reason is it used to be that, well, you would want to bunch in that first year, but if it started reducing your tax bracket, then those tax deductions weren't as valuable. So then you might back off at that point. Well, starting next year, even if you pushed yourself from that 37% bracket down to the 35% bracket, makes no difference at all, because you're already capped at 35%. So you would just keep stuffing money into that target year.
And the bunching doesn't only apply to contributing to donor advised funds. I mean, we could encourage our donors to bunch their gifts to us.
Exactly. So
directly,
if you've got a donor,
to us.
Let's say they've made a multi-year pledge. Hey, have a conversation with them that says, if you've got some financial flexibility, this is the year to take those deductions. You could prepay some of that pledge before the end of the year. It'd be more tax advantageous for you to do that.
It's time for Tony's Take Two.
Thank you, Kate. There's a lot of consternation, lots of talk about what GoFundMe did about 10 days ago when this gets released. They created 1.4 million GoFundMe pages for nonprofits without getting the consent of the 1.4 million nonprofits. So they created these 1.4 million pages in the name of all these charities without asking your permission. So you may very well have a GoFundMe page that you don't know about. And I urge you to go check GoFundMe to see if you are one of the many, many charities that they created a page for without asking you first. And there's a lot of consternation about this. I've posted on it on LinkedIn. You can see a post from me that reposts somebody else's post that also has a lot of detail. There are a lot of people talking about this. I see it all on LinkedIn about the ethics of doing this in all these charities' names without consent, prior approval. What about the money? How do you get the money? And if GoFundMe is not in touch with you, then how are you going to get the money that might be given to this page that you don't know about? You're going to look negligent to your fund, to your donors, if there are messages on the page that you haven't replied to or you haven't thanked the donors, but it's not really your fault because you don't know about the page that was created for you. Maybe at you, could say. So, you know, that's going to look bad. So you can opt out of the page. I mean, you can have the page taken down. A few people commented on LinkedIn that it's a bit of a process, but you can refuse the page. But first, you have to know that it's there. So I would recommend you take an action, go to GoFundMe, see if they've created a page in your name, and then you decide whether you want to keep it or not. You know, it's also another problem that I have is this is all very paternalistic. They just foist this page on you like you should have it. They know what's best for your fundraising stack. You don't know. Let us decide for you. You need a GoFundMe page. Well, totally inappropriate. So, trying to make everybody aware as best I can, and a lot of other commentators are doing the same thing. Please take a look at GoFundMe. That is Tony's Take Two. Kate?
That's really weird that they would make something in like someone else's name, your mission. I don't really know how GoFundMe works. I've only like donated to like a few people, but that's really weird. I don't like that.
Yeah. I mean, suppose they created a page in your name, like your individual name. You should have a GoFundMe because we know you're a college student. So you need a GoFundMe.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, right. I mean, that it's the same outrage.
We've got buku buttloads more time. Here's the rest of the new tax law, what it means for your fundraising right now and in 2026 with Russell James.
The ceiling that you mentioned, that 37 versus 35% ceiling, now that only applies to folks who are at higher income levels, or a $630,000 a year income level, right? Roughly. Can you just acquaint us with the details there? Just because I think a lot of our donors may not be at that level.
Exactly.
But for some who are, we want to be acquainted with it.
Right. So the basic idea is this. For every other tax deduction, the value of that tax deduction depends on what tax bracket are you in, right? If you're in a 10% tax bracket, tax deduction is worth 10 cents on the dollar. If you're in a 37% tax bracket, it's worth 37 cents on the dollar. Well, that changes next year for charitable deductions, which are going to be capped at 35 cents on the dollar or 35%. Now, again, that's not going to make any difference for folks that aren't at that highest tax bracket.
Right.
But for folks at that highest tax bracket, it is a haircut that they'll have to take starting next year.
Now we've got folks acquainted with bunching. Let's move back over to the non-itemizers and how a bunching strategy can be valuable for those folks, those non-itemizers, the 90% of taxpayers who just take the standard deduction year after year on the 1040 EZ form.
Yeah, so there's a couple of different ways to think about the value of bunching in that for that group. And primarily, it's the idea that if you've got some financial flexibility, if you can pre-fund several years worth of your giving by stuffing that money into your donor-advised fund, you can create a target year in which your deductions are high enough that you will be able to itemize in that target year.
It'll be advantageous. Itemizing would be advantageous in that target year.
Exactly, in that target year. Now, we've actually got some added flexibility starting next year because let's say you're in an off year and you're not planning to itemize because you've already stuffed that money in, but something special comes up or you want to make an additional gift directly, not through a donor-advised fund. You've now, for those non-itemizing years, you got that $1,000 off the top, above the line tax deduction that you can use. So a little bit more flexibility where even in the off years, you can take advantage of that charitable giving up to $1,000 a year.
Before we move more to the corporate side, I'm going to ask you, if you take off your researcher hat, all right, I'll take off my fundraiser hat. Can we realistically expect folks, plain folks, not wealthy, maybe don't have financial advisors, can we expect folks really to grasp the details of what we just talked about for 20 minutes?
One thing that will be super powerful, and that is very simply starting in January, you've got an above the line deduction for your charitable gifts. If you make $500 of gifts, that's $500 off of your income if you're not itemizing, right? So all of that 90% of non-itemizing folks, they get to deduct right off the top up to $1,000 per person. And that is going to be super powerful at encouraging people to at least participate in charitable giving. It reduces that cost for those kind of more moderate level donors up to $1,000 per person. That I think is the real power of this tax bill for the 90% typical donor.
Okay, that's great. That distilled it down to a simple message. You can now deduct your giving to us starting in 2026. You can now deduct your giving to us up to $1,000.
Exactly.
So
And
start.
by the way, that deduction is only for gifts that go directly to a real charity. So you can't stuff it into your donor-advised fund. That's got to be directly to an operating public charity.
Okay, thank you. That's an important footnote. Maybe it even belongs in the body, not in the footnote. All right. These are folks, if you're giving just up to $1,000 a year or so, you're not likely to have a donor advised fund. I mean, I'm making a generalization, but they might, but it's not likely. They're more likely to be sort of sustainer givers, $15, $20, $30 a month. Maybe $50 a month. So they're more likely to be those folks that, as you're saying, Russell, you can encourage into your giving circles, into your giving population, because it's now advantageous. The cost of their giving is reduced by the amount of their charitable deduction.
Exactly. And that they can't use that if they're stuffing it into a donor advised fund. So even if they have one, they're not going to put it there. They've got to send it directly to you.
All right. So a way, again, you've distilled it to a simple message, a way of using the bill to our advantage or using the big advantage in the bill to broaden the folks who are giving to you because you can give them the message that their giving is now reduced because they have up to $1,000 charitable deduction available that they
Right,
didn't
but wait
have.
until January to deliver
Right,
that
that they did
message.
not have in 2025. Yes,
Exactly.
that's the January 2026 and on message. Okay.
Exactly.
Okay. Let's focus a little more on corporate giving. Again, the overall message there, the high level message now, give now and avoid the 1% floor that you're facing in 2026.
Right. So we've got, again, that same message, pull it forward into 2025, but also from 2025 forward, bunching, that is typically using donor advised funds, is going to be key. And the reason I say that is when we look at the data, those corporations that are charitable donors, typically they're going to make gifts under or up to about 0.5% of their net income. Well, now we've got this floor that says, well, nothing counts until you're above 1% of your net income. So what does that mean? means if you want to get tax advantages, you're going to have to engage in bunching. You're going to have to stuff multiple years worth of your typical charitable transfers into a donor advised fund. So you have a target year, and then you have the off years when you're not going to be deducting those charitable gifts. So we're just going to see a lot more bunching taking place, because that's really the only way for the typical charitable, the typical corporation that makes charitable gifts, to get any tax advantages out of their giving.
I hope that's the reaction. I mean, the alternative reaction is less giving, less charitable giving.
No doubt. So we're trying to keep it positive, but it is okay. A slash to the tax benefits from giving. And I mean, these are corporations, they're profit-making entities, so they will respond to the cash incentives here.
Now, they're more likely to have tax advisors who would say it's advantageous to sell, accelerate into 2025, and the option of creating a donor advised fund that you mentioned. Now, that that's interesting, because, you know, corporations, we're not only talking about Walmart and Apple.
Right.
We're talking about local corporations, local your local car dealerships, smaller companies than that. I mean, any
C corporation.
Corporation, and you don't have to be Walmart to be a C corp.
No.
You could be a dry. You could be the local dry cleaner.
Exactly.
So you could even mention, you know, to, again, our listeners are in small and mid-sized shops. Mm-hmm. You could mention the possibility. You know, you might want to talk to your financial advisor about creating, about your company creating a donor advised fund.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you just remind folks what that looks like, so they. If they want to send that, if they want to give that message, they know what they've got some depth behind them. They know what they're talking about when they say, you know, your mom and pop dry cleaner, you might want to consider a donor advised fund. What does that mean?
Yeah. So one of the things to keep in mind is that these are super simple to set up, especially for people who are new to the concept. And I say that because places like, say, Fidelity Charitable, they have no account minimums. I mean, if you want to put $100 in and create a donor advised fund, you can do that now. Now, typically people put in more than that, but the idea is you can go in, create an account, Fidelity Charitable, Schwab Charitable. If you're going to be investing more, then maybe talk with your local community foundation. They will set these sort of things up. And what is it? Well, it's basically your charitable account or your charitable pocketbook. The reason we do that is because when we stuff money into our charitable account, that's when we get the tax deduction. And we have freedom as to when we're going to ship that money out to the various charities that we want to support. So that gives us this flexibility where we can take the big tax deduction up front by stuffing a bunch of money in, and we can use it to pre-fund things that are going to be transferred out to the charity over the next several years. So that's because of all of these floors and ceilings and all, you know, that's going to push people more and more into using these kinds of flexible strategies rather than just writing the check directly to the charity.
Right, which is still an option. You know, you can still talk to folks
still
about
an option.
Giving to you directly, but the donor advised fund, this is interesting. We may very well see Schwab and Fidelity and plus you mentioned the community foundations.
Yeah.
Your community foundation may very well host donor advised funds.
Exactly. Yes, right. Almost all of them do. That's that's the space they're in as well.
We may see an explosion in donor advised funds as folks want the flexibility. They see the need for bunching, but they want the flexibility when they're going to distribute to charities.
Everything in this new tax bill is pushing people towards bunching if they want to maximize their tax benefits, and that's typically done through donor advised funds.
Now, another strategy I saw someone propose for corporations, still on the corporate side, was redefining charitable giving as marketing expense, so that because marketing expenses don't have the 1% floor. Now, I don't know if that's tax accounting chicanery. I don't know. What do you have a sense of that?
Yeah, it can be a really great strategy, especially if fundamentally, if that's what the corporation is doing, right? We're making a gift so that you will advertise us and we get this sort of good will from that advertising. Then, before it was, well, it's a deduction either way, but now it might be, no, don't call this a charitable gift. We're going to pay you to engage in this marketing activity where you're going to put our name in some program, something related to your charitable activity. So that's very much a way to avoid all of this by just calling it, hey, we're spending money on PR and marketing here.
And that, again, with small companies, you know, a local company, it would be a redesignation for them internally, but I'm not advocating tax cheating by redefining charitable giving as marketing.
No, you want it to be legitimate, but often that actually is what the charitable giving is accomplishing from a corporate perspective.
Yeah, it's exposure and connection with a good local name. Mm-hmm. Your nonprofit. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. What haven't we talked about yet? Tax implications that you think listeners ought to know?
Well, one of the things to keep in mind is that there is so much power in income avoidance, that is tax avoidance, rather than just a tax deduction. Let me explain why. Now, as I mentioned before, tax avoidance is, let's say, for example, you don't sell something that has a profit in it. You donate that asset so you don't have to recognize the capital gain. Or if you're forced to take money out of your IRA rollover because of required minimum distributions, you don't take that money, have that income recognized. You instead ship it directly to the charity through qualified charitable distributions. The reason that that is so much more powerful is that when you keep your income low, it gives you additional benefits. For example, there's a brand new benefit. 2025, a senior age 65 and above with $75,000 of income gets the new $6,000 bonus deduction. But if their income gets higher than that, they start losing that deduction. So for example, if their income was $100,000, well, they only get $4,500 of that new bonus deduction, right? So it phases out as income goes up. Well, these income avoidance strategies, the idea of don't sell the asset, donate the appreciated asset, those become more powerful. And most people don't realize how easy this is. For example, I might say to somebody, you're going to make a large gift to the charity. Do you have any shares of stock that have gone up in value? And they might say, well, I've got those shares of Apple, but it's not really a good time to sell right now. The answer is to say, oh, you don't need to change your portfolio at all. Just donate the old shares of Apple stock to the charity and use that cash that you were going to have donated buy brand new shares of Apple stock. You don't change your portfolio at all, but you wipe out all of that capital gain. Now, this is something that can be done on the same day, in the same instant. Why? Because this is not lost property. If you sell lost property, there's a waiting period before you repurchase it. But this is gain property. This is stuff that's gone up in value. So we can ship the old shares to the charity, use the cash to buy brand new shares. It's just another way where we're taking advantage of this tax benefit that says give appreciated assets. Don't sell appreciated assets.
And you're saying donate the oldest shares because those are the ones that will have the highest amount of gain associated with them.
Exactly. Get the gain out of your portfolio. You don't have to change your portfolio. You just donate the old shares, use that cash to buy brand new identical shares.
And just a reminder, as you were talking about the qualified charitable distribution, the QCD, that's only for donors who are 70 and a half or older.
That's correct. Now, required minimum distributions don't start until age 73, but we can start doing these kinds of QCD gifts at age 70 and a half.
I've seen a lot of clients have a lot of success with the qualified charitable distributions because there are a lot of folks 70 and a half and over whose required minimum distribution is higher than they want. They don't They don't want all that money. But if you don't take it, if your donor doesn't take it starting age 70 and a half, then they're penalized. It's unbelievable. They're penalized, well, because the government wants the money out of your IRAs. You're penalized 50% of what you didn't take that you should have. So they're penalizing you for not taking your own money. And that's the advantage of the QCD for your charity, because these qualified charitable distribution dollars that go directly to you, as you said, Russell, they count toward your required minimum distribution, your donors. So it's helping them work off that required minimum distribution that they don't even want to begin with.
Exactly. So it's a really powerful strategy to keep in mind for the older donors. But you know, Tony, there's actually a way that everybody can use a similar benefit, which is this.
Okay.
On your IRA, 401k, any of that money that goes to your heirs, they've got to pay income taxes on every dollar. But any of that money that you add as your beneficiary designation, say 10% to your favorite charity, there's no income taxes on any of that. A lot of people miss that because they think, I don't have to worry about taxes in my estate planning because I don't have that $13 million, $26 million, whatever it is. No. You don't have to worry about estate taxes. You do have to worry about income taxes, because from the very first dollar of that IRA, 401k money, the heirs have got to pay income taxes on it. So if you're going to leave something to charity, those are the very first dollars we want to leave to charity.
I love it. Yep. That's the other way of using your IRA, 401k, 403b.
Exactly.
A lot of folks don't even know they have a 403b. That's your typically your TIAA CREF
exactly.
account. That's a 403b. They're the same. Name as a beneficiary designation and save your heirs. That is it income tax or an inherit? It's an income tax?
Income tax. Yeah. You don't have to worry about estate taxes unless you got a whole lot, but you got to worry about its income taxes from dollar one in that IRA or 401k.
All right. Russell, what else? You want to share something more? We have some more time together. You're a font of research, valuable research. I'm writing a book. I don't know if I told you, I'm writing a book on, basic planned giving, launching planned giving at your small and mid-sized nonprofit.
Great.
And you're in a couple of areas that you got to stay in touch with your older donors, because now we're shifting over to the planned giving side, but it's a planned giving book, because you can influence the likelihood that you remain in there, that your gift to your charity remain in their will, by communicating with them reliably, especially within the last 2 years, but you don't know when the last 2 years of their life is going to be, so you stay in touch with them all the time.
Yes.
The fact that planned giving does not, I hate this insidious myth, planned giving is going to hurt our other fundraising. Quite the contrary.
Yes.
Average 75% of people will increase their giving to that same charity once it's named their will. So I've got you cited in a couple places. I guess, I don't know, this is my first book. Am I supposed to have cleared this with you to use your...
No, just send me money whenever you cite me.
I mean, you're properly footnoted. All the research is footnoted. I just thought of this. Maybe I was supposed to ask if I can use your research.
No. I share all of my stuff for free. In fact, at encouragegenerosity.com, you can get digital versions of every book I've ever written, every slide set I've ever done, my videos, all that. It's all free. I mean, if you want to kill some trees and get the paper version, those are on Amazon, but the PDFs are there for free. So no, please do share that. And you make a great point. And this is something we're seeing as kind of the psychology of donors, that that the big distinction between a donor that will always be that small gift donor and a donor who becomes the major life investment gift donor is whether or not they think of giving as something that comes from their wealth. Or is it just disposable income sharing? If it just stays as a pocket change decision, it'll never get big. And for most people, the first time that they will ever commit to a gift from their wealth is when they do that with a gift and a will. And what we see is kind of a transformation in their giving once that commitment is made. On average, current giving goes up 77% after the gift in a will, the first charitable gift in a will is planned. And that's sustained 2, 4, 6, even 8 years later, it's still this much higher level. You know, another thing we see is that people's openness to making other asset gifts, like those gifts of stocks or real estate or IRAs, those are that openness is massively higher for people who have already committed to a gift from their wealth in that estate plan. So this is all kind of fitting together where it's the psychological component of how do you get a donor to think of their wealth as donation relevant. And that's what makes plan giving so powerful.
Yeah. You said 77%. I gave it a haircut. I said 75, 77%. I was there, so thank you. Yeah. And you know, you're the quantitative researcher. I think of this as it's happening because people feel so close to your work because once they've put you in their will, what have they done? They've elevated you alongside their husband, wife, partner, children, grandchildren, and sometimes even dear friends are in our wills. So they've elevated you to that status. I mean, it sometimes gives me goosebumps.
Yeah,
literally, I get to listen to folks about why they want to raise you to that status. And once they've done that, you're alongside their blood relatives, their dear loved ones. Why wouldn't they? You know, it almost becomes why wouldn't they do more for you?
Exactly.
That's on the passion, you know, that's on the passion human side, not the quantitative side. I can only cite like 28 years of plan giving fundraising. I only have 28 years of anecdotes. You've got the quantitative research, which obviously I'm grateful for. That's why it's cited in the book I'm writing.
Thank you for that.
To back up what my 28 years of anecdotes always suggested.
Sure. Yeah. Absolutely. We definitely see that. We see that in practice, and those things actually are giving the same answers.
All right. I'm glad the humanity and the quantitative, statistical, chi-squared valued, chi-square validated research are lining up the same. All right.
Exactly.
Russell, thank you so much. I know I got you at a busy time, but thank you. Thanks for sharing with Nonprofit Radio listeners. Very valuable for now and for 2026.
Great to be here. Appreciate the invitation, Tony.
My pleasure to have you. Russell James, again, you'll find that valuable and generously given research of his, including his books, at encouragegenerosity.com. I was happy to be a beta reader for your... Is it still your most recent book?
I'm trying to think.
Or is it no
the most recent big book, anyway.
Big
I do
book.
Small
okay.
things along the way.
All right. And you can connect with Russell on LinkedIn, where he is very active. Russell, thanks again. So good to see you. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Tony.
Next week, flow and do your best work. If you missed any part of this week's show,
I beseech you. Find it at tonymartinetti.com.
Our creative producer is Claire Meyerhoff. I'm your associate producer, Kate Martinetti. The show's social media is by Susan Chavez. Mark Silverman is our web guy. And this music is by Scott Stein.
Thank you for that affirmation, Scotty. Be with us next week for Nonprofit Radio. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. Go out and be great!